I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Frederick Brandfen, author of Intimate Strangers, A History of Jews and Catholics in the City of Rome. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. I sang in an event last week celebrating Israel's 75th anniversary, Yom HaAtzmaut, and there were a few protesters outside. While there was concern in advance among the organizers that the event might be disrupted, it wasn't. A few people held big Palestinian flags and signs reading, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," and chanted some slogans. Not exactly a large or violent protest, and it had no impact on the celebration. But the very sloganeering of the protesters, and in truth, protests always come down to oversimplified slogans and chants or songs, the very sloganeering made me wonder at the maximalism of those who resent Israel and the Jewish state. It is perfectly reasonable to protest the Israeli treatment of Palestinians. America is a free country, and public protest of what we don't like is a First Amendment-protected expression of free speech, provided it stays nonviolent. Of course, it would make more sense to protest China's much worse treatment of the Uyghurs, or Myanmar's genocidal treatment of the Rohingya, or Putin's armies and their Wagner Group allies, the mercenaries, their many war crimes in Ukraine. But since protesting those much more terrible situations, or say protesting the outbreak of civil war in Sudan, isn't apparently as popular as attacking Israel these days, well, these folks were protesting against Israel. Fine. But to shout, "From the river to the sea, Palestine must be free," is just, well, stupid. It makes it clear that their goal in protesting is not just liberating Palestinians from the limitations they function under so that they can have full lives in their own nation. It is the complete destruction of the State of Israel. And that's a vicious goal and slightly deranged. Israel, the only Jewish nation on the planet, has close to 10 million citizens. It is the strongest nation in the Middle East, militarily, economically, and politically. It isn't going anywhere. In fact, it continues to grow, thrive, and develop at remarkable rates. If you want to protest the difficulty of Palestinians' lives, well and good. But if you want to destroy Israel to give the Palestinians the entire country from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea, that's the slogan, you are living in a fantasy world of shabby manufacture. It ain't happening. Not now, not in 25 years, not in 50 years, not in another 75 years. Look, I don't think Israel does a great job in its complicated responsibilities in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, where the Palestinian Authority has the official lead role, but Israeli security forces are ubiquitous. It stinks to be an Arab living in the West Bank or East Jerusalem and have to clear a variety of roadblocks, ID checks, and security closures every single day. The Palestinian Authority, Fatah and its leadership, is geriatric and super corrupt, and they do very little to help their own people. Extremist terror groups like Hamas and Islamic Jihad and the Muslim Brotherhood are suppressed by the Palestinian Authority and Israeli security forces, but do have a following and certainly are dangerous. Primarily Orthodox Israeli settlers are militant themselves, and seem bent only on expanding their settlements. there is little in the way of economic opportunity for Arabs in the Palestinian territories, and the best and brightest young people leave for Europe, the U.S., and other Arab countries, all of which mediates in favor of a solution at some point to fix their miserable situation. Unfortunately, there is not an obvious fix now, and there may not be for a considerable time to come. Most importantly, if you start the discussion of Palestinian rights and needs by targeting Israel's existence, that preposterous from the river to the sea language, you are closing minds and hearts and encouraging a ridiculous and destructive fantasy. I would love to see a realistic two-state solution come to pass. Palestinians in a demilitarized state enjoying the benefits Israel currently enjoys: a modern economy, highly educated population, actual democracy, and cultural excellence. It can happen someday, I pray, but it won't happen because protesters 9 or 10,000 miles away advocate the destruction of the state of Israel. As we have said many times here on Too Jewish, Israel is an amazing country and a highly successful nation. Imperfect and wonderful. To play us in on Too Jewish this morning, here's a song from Israel at its 75th Independence Day last week, Toda Levare, Thank You to the Creator, by Kobi Peretz.
ולפעמים אנחנו לא קולטים את התמונה הנכונה ושנמשיך לסמוך לדורות להגשים את כל החלומות ולזכור שיש הרבה סיבות לחבק מקרוב ולא יום חדש ושנמשיך לסמוך לדורות להגשים את כל החלומות ולזכור שיש הרבה סיבות לחבק מקרוב ולא לעזוב תודה שיפריד בינינו יחד כל היום
That was Kobi Peretz's song, Toda Levare, Thank You to the Creator of All the Good in This Land, which we enjoy together. Jews have lived and had a significant Jewish community in Rome for over 2,000 years, but it hasn't been a simple relationship with the ruling authorities, especially the Pope and the Roman Catholic Church. Hear all about it when our guest this morning, Frederick Brantman, author of Intimate Strangers, A History of Jews and Catholics in the City of Rome, joins us right here on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Frederick Brantman is the author of a remarkable new book, Intimate Strangers, A History of Jews and Catholics in the City of Rome. He is the former chairman of the Department of Philosophy and Religion at Stockton University in New Jersey, founder of the Department of Religious Studies at the College of Charleston in South Carolina. By the way, that's a beautiful place. Has written extensively on Roman and Italian Jewish history and has published really a very important and valuable book published by Jewish Publication Societies. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Good morning.
So, whenever I think of, and I've been to Rome many times, I find the whole relationship of the this incredibly important Jewish community and Rome itself and the papacy quite fascinating. Tell us why you decided to write this book now.
Well, I mean, it's personal, sort of. In the book, I was being given a tour of the Vatican by a Jewish art historian woman, and we were headed over towards the chapel, and she just happened almost offhandedly to say, "Oh, by the way, that fireplace over there, that's where my grandparents slept during World War II when they were hiding from the Nazis."
In the Vatican hallway on the way to the Sistine Chapel.
Correct. And this is one of those, moments where you say, wait a minute, could you back up for a second here?
Yeah, hang on there.
Could you start from the beginning? Did the Pope know about this? And of course he did. It was Pope Pius himself, and of course he did. But it was at that point that I realized that there was a story to be told here. I wanted to get to start from the beginning, and so I went back 2,000 years.
Look, I think that's the right way to explore history of important places and communities. I was always told that the Jewish community of Rome started in Maccabean times under the Hasmoneans when there was a disagreement between two Hasmonean brothers for the leadership and kingship. They sent emissaries and representatives, and that was the genesis of the Jewish community of Rome. Is that true?
More or less. Yes, we have records of that. Would we like more corroboration of exactly that's how it happened? Difficult. We don't. But we do have corroboration in the form of some records that by 139 BCE, there were Jews in Rome. And these Jews in Rome were being ordered to leave by a low-level official who didn't really have the authority over Jewish inhabitants. Only had authority over people who were passing through Rome. I only had authority as long as he held his post, which was 2 years. So Jews were not expelled from Rome in 139 B.C., and in that regard, we know that they were there.
Yeah, it's fascinating, those kinds of details. I also remember once accidentally turning in the wrong direction of the Vatican and finding all these Jewish gravestones that had been excavated when they were building the palace there. We will talk much more with Frederick Brantman. The book is called Intimate Strangers, A History of Jews and Catholics in the City of Rome. We didn't even get to the Christian part yet, but we certainly will when we come back here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community, striving every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the whole metropolitan area. We have weekly Friday night and Saturday morning Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming, and we will have a new permanent home this summer. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary in person. 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Religious school is available for school-age children or grandchildren, a fabulous Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah program, Torah Tykes experience, confirmation, teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Beit Simcha services, classes, and events are open to everyone Friday night and Saturday morning. You can come by going to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, for information, or join us on our Facebook page about evening celebration services, always at 6:30 p.m., Saturday Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., preceded at 9 a.m., with Torah study, all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson. Our musical services are in person and by virtual experience weekly. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. You can access those by emailing rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org or signing up on our website. Religious school is available in blended format, too. Some students live, some on Zoom. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to religious school, Torah Tykes programs, Friday night, Saturday morning services, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses, and all of our services, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona in our new building starting this summer. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or a criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, toojewishradio.com, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 200,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify, too. Post a rating, review 2 Jewish, wherever you listen to us, those comments help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of Southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about the role of rabbis and Jewish educators and other figures in the Jewish community in the kind of advancing Zionism, if you will, and around the 75th anniversary of Israel, how much that's changed. But we've also been talking about kind of the challenge the diaspora is facing now. And you want to talk about Stockholm?
Yes, and forgive me if I already mentioned this on some earlier show, but I recently was asked to consult with the development director of something called Paideia, which is an institution in Stockholm that exists to educate and energize young Jews, by which they mean Jews between 25 and 40. So people who are university graduates, but still considered young in terms of the Jewish community. And this institution is underwritten financially by an odd, completely unexpected cast of characters. The European Commission, which is the kind of executive branch of the European Union, the government of Sweden, the Jewish Agency, and several others, but those are the big three. And what it does is it invites Jews in that age bracket from all over Europe to come and study and learn how to program and learn how to put meat on the bare bones of their ideas for how to revitalize their particular Jewish community, whether it's Barcelona or Poznan or wherever it might be. So in the course of my consulting with this woman, who is like half Israeli, half American, lives in Israel, and is probably early next month making a fundraising trip to LA. So I said, you know, Paideia has no name recognition in America. You have to fix that. She said, well, how could I fix it? I gave her a few hopefully helpful suggestions.
She certainly should talk to Too Jewish. I'm just saying, you know.
But then it occurred to me that very few people would even guess this as a remote possibility. In Sweden, of all places, Yiddish is recognized as an official national language. Even if only, you know, a quarter of 1% of the population speaks Yiddish, it's a legitimate minority. It's a legitimate language that has been spoken in Sweden for more than 100 years, and it is subsidized. So anybody who wants to give a course in Yiddish or have anything to do with creating Yiddish literature or whatever is subsidized by the Swedish government, much to my amazement.
That's wild. You know, it's funny. The truth is the first songs I ever performed as a singer were in Yiddish. They were at Holocaust events, but also like Gebirtig, stuff like that. And, you know, there used to be an obvious audience for that. And now if you want to find an audience for Yiddish song besides New York City, you go to the festival, in the Jewish festival in Krakow,
right,
which is 10,000 non-Jews and, you know, maybe 1,000 Jews.
I mean, or 100.
Or 100. Yeah, it depends. Well, it's more than 100. But still, it's pretty wild to think about that. By the way, if they want to fly a rabbi out to consult to Stockholm, I'm available. I just want you to know that. Tom, we'll continue to talk about Israel and the diaspora when we come back next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A couple goes to see the rabbi for a blessing to have children because they've been trying and haven't had any luck. The rabbi says, "You came at the right time. I'm going to Israel. I'll write a note with your names on it and a prayer for children and put it in the Kotel, the Western Wall in Jerusalem." 5 years later, the rabbi runs into the woman. He says, "So, did you have children? Was your prayer answered?" She says, "Yes, Rabbi, we have 11 children." 11 kids in 5 years, says the rabbi. "Yes, Rabbi. The first year we had twins. The second year we had twins. Then just one. Then we had triplets. Then we had triplets again." "That's incredible. A nest, a miracle. Where's your husband?" "He's in Israel right now." "Really? Is he there on business?" "No, he's at the Kotel, the Western Wall. He's looking for that danged note." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Two Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. Now a word of Torah. Emor, our portion this week in Leviticus, begins as so many others do. God gives commands to the people of Israel, but the language is a little different this time. Usually, mitzvot, commandments, begin with the Hebrew word daber, speak to the children of Israel. Occasionally, it's tzav, command the children of Israel. This time, it's a much softer word. Emor, say to the priests, the children of Aaron. Why? There's a clue in the continuation of the first sentence of our portion. The center actually begins, say to the priests, and then adds, and say to them. Commentators do not believe the Torah is ever truly redundant, so the Talmud teaches that there is a subtle message here. Be cautious in how we adults speak to children. Emor means speak softly and kindly. Good advice teaching children at any time. But why specifically is this word emor used twice in regard to the priestly commands? After all, priests are not children. Perhaps the essence lies in the central message of holiness given to our ancestors, articulated so forcefully at the start of last week's portion of Kiddushim. You shall all be holy, for I, God, am holy. Here in emor, as the specifics of the designated representatives of the people in holiness are articulated, the change to a softer language is notable. The priests are the ones who actually have to help the people achieve holiness. They must be given the careful, scrupulous requirements, but also inspired to do that work with devotion and passion. There will be balance to maintain between conscientious, obsessive attention to detail and communicating the sacredness of their calling to the Jewish people, who are not as occupied with its processes and may not be as emotionally invested in it as the priests are. Thus, the word used here is emor, speak, explain, teach, inspire, not simply daber, tell, command, order, require. In leading anyone towards holiness, there must be a serious, conscientious devotion to quality. Badly performed rituals, like terrible services, inspire no one. But there must also be a demonstrated process of caring about the way those processes are experienced by the devotees. Even, perhaps, especially, a love for both process and result. This week of Emor, may we be inspired to seriously and caringly seek to find holiness in our lives through our own Jewish practice, and so inspire others to do so as well. When we come back in a moment, our guest this morning, Frederick Branfund, tells us just how the Catholic Church viewed and related to the Jewish community of Rome. It's a fascinating story. Find out when we come back in a moment on Two Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The news from Israel this week is, well, essentially no news. Israel's 75th birthday and the Yom HaZikaron, the Israeli Memorial Day that preceded it, passed with only the expected celebrations and ceremonies, without major protests or any meaningful disruptions. That's, of course, very good news, and it belies the serious concerns that this year's big festivities could devolve somehow into disaster. There were some scattered protests, but in general, the 75th birthday of Israel passed with joy in Eretz Yisrael. Undoubtedly, good Israeli security and advanced intelligence contributed to that lack of bad news. But it sure is nice to report that this signal moment in the Jewish state's history went so well that there is nothing bad to say about it, only good.
Time.
major development for British Jewry, the United Kingdom's liberal and reform movements are joining to create a unified progressive Judaism movement after working separately for more than 120 years. The historic project, culmination of decades of discussions and rapprochement, is to be led by the Reform Movement's newly appointed CEO, Rabbi Josh Levy. He is leaving his role as the lead rabbi of the Northwestern Reform Synagogue in London, as well as Liberal Judaism CEO, Rabbi Charles Baginski. The union was made possible in part by the decision of the UK Reform Movement in 2015 to accept patrilineal Jews, that is, Jews with a Jewish father but not a Jewish mother, as full members of communities. That American model is embraced by the liberal movement, but most European reform organizations require patrilineal Jews to go through conversion to become full members of their communities. Today, the two British movements share their welcome of mixed faith families and fully egalitarian services, Baginski said last week. We are as one on everything, from campaigning for same-sex marriage to training rabbis and educators to offering provision for students and young people. What's the difference between liberal and reform Judaism has therefore become a question that rabbis, cantors, lay leaders, and even PR people have struggled to answer, Baginski and Levy wrote in an op-ed in the UK Jewish News. Paul Langford, co-chair of the Reform Movement in England, assured members of both groups that no one will be asked to change their synagogue name, their Reform identity, or their prayer book. He added that input from members was welcome and would shape future policies. London-based Institute for Jewish Policy Research reported that as of 2021, there were 271,000 Jews living in England and Wales, up from 265,000 in 2011 and 259,000 in 2001. That is still just 0.5% of the total population of England and Wales. Progressive Jews will altogether make up about 30% of those who are affiliated with synagogues in the UK. There are now more than 80 progressive communities all over the country. Rabbis for both movements are trained at the London-based Leo Beck College, although they do take rabbis from Hebrew Union College also. The distinction between liberal and reform Judaism in the UK has always been confusing, even to rabbis. It was the only country to have two quite similar progressive movements, essentially employing the same clergy. They used, and may continue to use, slightly different prayer books, and the liberal movement used less Hebrew and was even more politically progressive than the reform movement. But for those of us who didn't grow up with the British model, it was pretty hard to tell the difference or to understand why they needed two entire movements to encompass what the U.S., Canada, and everywhere else managed to put into one reform movement. And now they came to that realization themselves. Mazel tov and cheers. In New York, beginner and intermediate Talmud courses are back on the course schedule for undergraduate students at Yeshiva University's Stern College for Women after an uproar over their cancellation. Stern College administrators said the school would not offer beginning and intermediate Talmud courses about this foundational Jewish text for women at the country's flagship modern Orthodox university because of low enrollment. That prompted more than 1,400 women students, graduates, and others to sign a petition urging the school to reinstate the classes and endow a full-time chair of Talmud studies. Now, Stern College for Women says it is adding several Talmud classes to next semester's schedule, citing the increased interest among students. It was heartwarming to see the outpouring of interest revolving around women's Talmud learning on the Barron campus. Shoshana Schechter, Stern's Associate Dean of Torah and Spiritual Life, and Dina Rabinovich, Chair of the Jewish Studies Department, said in a letter last week. "This is great news," said Tamar Beer Horowitz, one of the organizers of the petition. "It's amazing how much we were able to accomplish in just a few days. I think it really showed people how much this means. Everyone got a very clear message about the fact there is interest in Talmud, and this is something valuable for women." Singer and activist Harry Belafonte, whose grandfather was a Dutch Jew, died last week. While raised a Catholic, Belafonte had an early success singing Hava Nagila at the Village Vanguard. That became extremely popular. That rendition made him, as he jokingly said, the most popular Jew in America in the 1950s, although, of course, wasn't actually Jewish. Harry Belafonte, the king of Calypso, whose social activism and work against racism allied him with many Jewish activists along the way in the civil rights movement, also recorded a number of Israeli folk songs along the way. And Jerry Springer, son of Jewish refugees who set aside a political career to become a ringleader of a circus-like syndicated talk show featuring feuding couples, angry exes, and frequent fisticuffs, died last week at the age of 79. Over nearly 5,000 episodes that ran from 1991 to 2018, Jerry Springer transformed daytime television with a program designed to encourage conflict among guests, often physical conflict, where rivals like Oprah Winfrey and Phil Donahue interviewed celebrities and tackled serious issues. Springer brought on everyday people and pitted them against one another in shows about incest, adultery, and polyamory. Springer's path to television notoriety was not preordained. He was actually born in a London tube station in 1944 during a World War II Nazi bombing raid. His parents, Richard and Margot Springer, were German-Jewish refugees from the Nazis. They escaped from Prussia to Britain in 1939, just before the outbreak of the war. 27 members of Springer's family were killed in the Holocaust. His family immigrated to Queens in New York City. His first career after earning a law degree from Northwestern University was politics. Jerry Springer worked on the 1968 presidential campaign of Robert F. Kennedy that ended with Kennedy's assassination, then ran a failed campaign for U.S. Congress in 1970 before being elected to the Cincinnati City Council in 1971. 1977, Jerry Springer was elected mayor of Cincinnati. He had a successful single one-year term. After serving as mayor, he anchored the news for the NBC affiliate in Cincinnati for 10 years before making the leap to syndicated TV. The Jerry Springer Show started with more high-minded intentions, but as ratings dipped, he embraced the sensational. The TV series was produced and aired by NBC Universal and the CW and earned Springer a fortune. In 2000, he had a five-year, $30 million contract extension, paying him $6 million a year. Springer later supported the preservation of Holocaust archives in Britain. He was the subject of a musical called Jerry Springer the Opera that ran in London 15 years ago and was revived off-Broadway in 2018. As Springer said in an interview, "We certainly made a difference in television. I'm not sure people are happy about it. I try not to think about it too much. Life is what it is, and you take what's handed, and you work as hard as you can, and hopefully you'll be successful. I just don't spend too much time worrying about that. I do my show. I've always said it's a stupid show. I've had a wonderful life because of it and all that, but I've never for a second thought that it's important. It's trivial. It's chewing gum. I recognize that." And that's the news of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Frederick Brandfund, is the author of Intimate Strangers, A History of Jews and Catholics in the City of Rome, former chairman of the Department of Philosophy and Religion at Stockton University in New Jersey, and the founder of the Department of Religious Studies at the College of Charleston in South Carolina. We started talking about the origins of the Jewish community in Rome. One of the really, I think, profound themes, it's in the title, Intimate Strangers, is about the close relationship and the complex relationship that Jews have first with Romans and then ultimately with Catholics in Rome. Tell us the story of Berenice, would you? It's only a semi-famous story for Jews.
Well, the story of Berenice is that she was queen of Judea at the time of the Jewish revolt, first Jewish revolt, around 70 CE, and she was, first of all, politically astute. I mean, she understood that that revolt was not going to succeed, but she also was, apparently, we don't know personally, but she seems to be relatively opportunistic, and when Titus, who was the son of the Emperor Vespasian, succeeded in destroying Jerusalem and burning the temple. She was able to insinuate herself and become Titus's consort, his mistress, lover, and she went back to Rome with him as his lover, and she went voluntarily. And, of course, there was the possibility that he would marry her. He never did. And that if he did marry her, of course, the future emperors of Rome might be Jewish, which caused a tremendous amount of anxiety for certain people. And he lived in Rome for a while as his consort for a few years. But eventually he was forced by his political opponents, advisors, even to exile her back to Judea, which is where she went. And she has been, of course, the subject, because this sort of juicy story has been the subject of a number of plays, classical plays, French. There have been operas by Mozart. There's a novel by Howard Fast, an American writer. She is the subject of a lot of literature and imagination. And I just would add, I'm sure you know if you looked in the book, that history doesn't repeat itself, but 20th century, Mussolini, who styled himself as a new Roman emperor, had for himself also a Jewish lover, and this woman, Margherita Sarfatti, was his lover for many years, many more years than Berenice was for Titus, and she wrote his speeches, she wrote his articles, she was Jewish and a fascist, but when she got older, he became less interested in her. She converted to Catholicism to no avail, and she had to be exiled herself from Italy to Argentina when she saw the handwriting on the wall during World War II.
You know, it's fascinating. It's kind of a variation on the court Jew theme. It's sort of the court consort theme, if you will. I always think of Berenice as almost like a Cleopatra figure, except, of course, not with the exact same tragic ending. Tell us a little bit, when Christianity began, it was a highly persecuted religion in Rome. That was true really right up until Constantine. What was the relationship like between the Jews of Rome and the early Christians?
Well, you know, this we only have from, we don't only have, but we have a great deal of information from the Gospels, especially from, the letter to the Romans.
Right.
What it was, it was an ambiguous relationship, which is that I'm not quite certain that Jews took much notice of the new group because there were many different, cult religions in Rome and in the classical world at that time. And but, of course, Roman Christians had to deal with the fact that there were Jews who were not believing in Jesus, and yet they believed that their God had become a Jewish person incarnate. And so what this created was a very ambiguous relationship between Christians and Jews, which persists to this day and persisted for thousands of years with very difficult and tragic results for Jews.
The Roman Jewish community, what becomes known much later as the ghetto, is in very close proximity physically to really the center of papal power. Can you talk about that kind of geographic relationship?
Well, the geographic relationship is remarkable in that they're right across the river from each other. Rome is divided by the Tiber River, a decent-sized river, and on one side of the river is the area that Pope Paul IV designated as ghetto, a place where Jews had to live and had to be walled in and had to stay there within the wall at night. The gate was closed. On the other side of the river is this magnificent papal palace with gardens and libraries, and you can see one from the other. They're right there. What happened, of course, was that not only were Jews required to live in the ghetto, but that the Catholic Church set up churches at the gates of the ghetto so that when Jews exited, they saw the churches, and the churches, at least the one that we have presently today, have Hebrew inscriptions on them, welcoming them into the church if they want to convert. The Hebrew inscriptions come from the book of Isaiah, which is saying that all are welcome. So the geographically, they're, sheep by jowl.
Tell us a little bit about the foundation of the ghetto, how it evolved in Rome. Obviously, the first ghetto was in Venice, beginning of the 16th century. The Roman ghetto is incredibly important. Tell us a little bit about how it came about and what its relationship was to the papacy, actually.
Well, Paul IV was a very conservative, and he was also a pope just for a few years, beginning in around 1555, during the Counter-Reformation. And the church was being challenged in Northern Europe, outside of Italy, by, of course, the Protestant Reformation, the Lutheran, Calvinist, whatever. And as a reaction to that, the Pope Paul IV wanted to make certain that his church was guarded and preserved. And, of course, what he wanted to do also was increase converts to Catholicism. If he was losing persons of the Catholic faith to the Protestant faith in the north, he wanted to increase the number of persons converted to the Catholic faith in Rome, and he believed that if he basically incarcerated the Jews in this ghetto, they could leave during the day, but they had to be there at night, and if he restricted their ability to do any work at all, they were only allowed to work in the rag trade, where they could collect rags and maybe make mattresses out of rags. And if he was able to do that, that they would eventually convert to Catholicism.
There's a famous Robert Browning poem about the Jews sardonically listening to the sermon that they were compelled to listen to every year from the Pope.
The Jews were compelled to listen to conversionary sermons once a week.
Weekly,
they had
sorry.
To. It was decreed that a certain number of Jews per week had to go to a church, which is just outside of Trastevere, and they had to listen to conversionary sermons. Jews tried to avoid, by first of all, bringing into the church cotton and wool wax to stop up their ears, in order to, so that they wouldn't hear it, even physically present. There was also a trade for Jews, and would say, well, will you take my place during this week? And people would trade off having to go. On the other hand, although this was onerous for Jews in a terrible way, on the other hand, the church did say that Jews didn't have to go there during the high holidays. They didn't have to go there on their own Sabbath. They didn't have to go there during the week of Passover. They didn't have to go to a conversion sermon during the week of Hanukkah. And, of course, there were even snow days. If it snowed, which it doesn't, it don't really, but if it snowed, they didn't have to go either. So, in fact, the effect of the conversionary sermons was mitigated in all sorts of different ways. And, of course, the ultimate goal of converting Jews did not really come to be.
The Jewish community in Rome lived in this ghetto under complicated circumstances, but I think I've heard it described that the walls of the ghetto were really like a semi-permeable membrane, that there was a relationship that developed, and in your kind of theme of intimate strangers, I think that becomes clear. Can you explore that a little bit?
Yes, well, of course, Jews were allowed out every day do some business. I mean, maybe collect rags, or we have records of Jewish musicians had to go to certain shops in Rome to get strings for their lute and pairs for their musical instruments. Jews also then used those musical instruments to play music at Christian or Catholic weddings. It was something that the Catholics were perfectly comfortable with. Jewish community was not, but it happened anyway. No. Of course, there's one quite interesting story about a guard for the Pope who actually ran the Papal Guard, and he had an estate outside of, and he had a picnic. We know of only one picnic, but he may have had more, or other people may have had them. He had a picnic in which he invited his own family and invited a Catholic judge and the Catholic judge's wife and the Catholic judge's children. And they also invited six Jews to play music at the picnic. They did play music at the picnic. They had a very good time as far as we know. And in fact, as the sun set, they all strolled back to Rome, and the Jewish lute player, his name is Abramo, was singing along with the judge's wife as they strolled. Probably they had a bit of wine as they strolled back to Rome. So, yeah, it was quite permeable in that regard. There was constant contact. It wasn't that there wasn't contact. What it was, of course, that there could be no marriages between Jews and Catholics.
Right, of course. And you couldn't convert Catholics to Judaism. I mean, there were a number of other issues, but I want to just briefly, because we're running out of time, there's a horrific massacre of the Jews of Rome. I mean, well, massacre and then carry it off by the Nazis during World War II. But many Catholics protected Jews where they could. Can you talk about that a little bit? It becomes clear in the book.
In 1943, unfortunately, Mussolini was overthrown and the Nazis realized their chief ally was going to become an ally of Great Britain and the States. They rushed their Nazi troops to Rome, took Rome, and then it was the order came down that every Jew in Rome must be killed. The 2,000-year-old community must be entirely wiped out. Old, young, sick, poor, they all had to be taken to Auschwitz and killed. And Catholics in the city knew about this, as did Jews, and they offered their home, and Catholic churchmen offered their churches and convents and monasteries. There were about 8,000 Jews in Rome at the time, and thousands of Jews were saved by individual Catholics and Catholic institutions throughout Rome because the institutions were off limits to the Gestapo, as they couldn't enter them. I mean, sometimes they did, but generally speaking, they could not, and Jews were therefore, if they were within the walls of a convent, they were safe. And then individual Jews went into people's homes and were saved. And to the extent that thousands of Jews were saved by individual Catholics and the Catholic Church out of 8,000, so it was a terrific effort. And there would be no Jewish community in Rome today without the effort of these individual Catholics and Catholic institutions.
It's a fascinating book, Intimate Strangers. And by the way, there's certain insults that go back and forth. There's a discomfort that exists between Christian, Catholic, Italians, and Jews, and yet there's also this closeness and this supportiveness. By the way, Italy protected a higher percentage of its Jews than virtually any other country in Europe. I mean, aside from ones with tiny populations like Denmark, just sort of worth keeping in mind. Frederick, where can people go to find out more about Intimate Strangers, to find out more about you?
Well, thank you. Of course, the book is now on Amazon, and it's on Barnes & Noble, so you can purchase the book. It will not be available. If you purchase it, pre-purchase it, you won't get it till May 1st.
Coming up very soon. Thank you very much. I want to finish. There's a great story you start with in the book where the Pope greets the Jews. This is Pope John of Vatican II fame, in which he says, "I am Joseph, your brother." It's a remarkable emotional moment, and it highlights just the complexity of this relationship. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate this very much.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Russ Linden, management consultant and author of Loss and Discovery, What the Torah Can Teach Us About Leading Change. And join us, Congregation Beit Simcha, every Friday night for services in Onig Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, live in person and on our Facebook page. Our playout this morning comes from Benny Friedman for Yom HaAtzmaut last week. Yesh Tikva, we have hope. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.